Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the recent restoration of San Francisco's Coit Tower. Coit Tower on San Francisco's Telegraph Hill is one of the most beloved landmarks of the city, a monument within a park, and home to dozens of Depression-era murals and paintings. Noted for their depiction of everyday life in the 30s, their hopeful vision for the future, and in some cases, their radical political content. It's also prone to leaks, structural challenges, and damage from visitor use, and accordingly just underwent a six-month repair and restoration and reopened to the public in May. Tonight, we'll speak with those involved in the $1.7 million project. What was involved in the restoration, and what have we discovered anew about the monument? How will future upkeep be funded, and what more have we learned about the monument's artistic and historical significance? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues are Tom DeCaney. He's Director of Cultural Affairs with the San Francisco Arts Commission. Before coming to the commission, Tom was an independent consultant, strategist, and facilitator in the fields of arts and culture, youth development, and education. He also served as Executive Director of Performing Arts Workshop, a San Francisco-based arts education organization. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined here by David Wessel. He is principal of Architectural Resources Group and CEO of ARG Conservation Services, where he specializes in the restoration and repair of historic resources, including murals, statues, and landmark buildings. Welcome, David.
Pleasure to be here.
We're also joined in the studio by Ann Rosenthal, principal of Ann Rosenthal Fine Art Conservation, where she specializes in restoring wall paintings. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're also joined by Cassandra Costello. She is property manager with San Francisco Recreation and Park Department. Previously, she served as a legislative aide to supervisors Eric Marr and Jake McGoldrick. Welcome, Cassandra.
Thank you, Joseph. Happy to be here.
And we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join our conversation. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website, or you can take this phone number down and we'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. That number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And let's get started. So, Tom DeCaney from the Arts Commission, take us back to the days of Lily Coit. Describe how Coit Tower came to be.
Well, the city of San Francisco was fortunate enough to receive a gift from Lily Coit. She wanted to create a monument to the fire department, and the Arts Commission took on the charge. And at the time, the Arts Commission had one of the Arts Commissioners, a very powerful business tycoon named Herbert Fleischacker, and he took on the charge to have Coit Tower move forward. And I think what's interesting about Coit Tower is now it's an icon we all recognize and love as iconic San Francisco. But at the time, it was a quite controversial project. So in addition to a number of neighbors feeling that it was a scare on the skyline of San Francisco, there were actually a couple of other arts commissioners who also did not like the design and were kind of dissenters in the approval of the final design we see today. So I think what's great about this story is it is a reminder that these monuments and art in the public domain is oftentimes comes with controversy and dissent. And I think that's what's exciting about art and democracy and art in the public space. And clearly, we know now that that debate of the time has resulted in an iconic part of our city skyline, something that we all recognize as essential San Francisco, and something here today we're all celebrating its restoration.
So tell me a little bit more about Lily Coit.
Well, Lily Coit was quite a character in San Francisco, and she was, I think, well known for being a big personality and for being a fan of the fire department. You know, at our recent restoration,
she said Chase Fires, is that right?
She was a big fan of the fire department, and I think recognized the importance that firefighters play in the security of our city. Obviously, from the Great Fire after the earthquake, and really recognizing that firefighters are a legacy in the city and that they're critical to our to our safety. And so that was kind of the impetus for her gift to the city. I think to continue to build on this story, I know she, in leaving this legacy and kind of Herbert Fleischacker's championing of the project, it was also interesting to note that Fleischacker had a very interesting relationship with the mayor at the time. The mayor personally owed him $1 million, which in the 1930s was quite a significant amount of money. And so despite protests from the public and from two of the arts commissioners, Fleischacker got his kind of project moving forward, and the city would actually go on to purchase 5,000 barrels of cement from one of Fleischacker's companies to build the tower. So at the time, it was, you know, quite a political project, and so I think that that political history is interesting as well.
So you mentioned the controversy about the design of the building. What was so controversial about it?
Well, I think some people just felt that it was, you know, there was this wonderful natural beauty of Telegraph Hill, which remains today, and that people felt it was going to damage that and that it was going to be an obstruction to some of the views from Telegraph Hill. And it was not a design, I think, that everybody initially saw and appreciated. But I think it goes to show that some the visioning of groundbreaking design sometimes can be disruptive and it can be something that everybody loves at first. But I think clearly we know now that Coy Tower, its design and the vision of the tower was pretty forward-thinking and now is home to some of the, I think, greatest art we have in San Francisco.
So speaking about that art, let's go inside for a moment and talk about how the murals came to be associated with Coy Tower. Was that a part of the original plan to actually have the murals painted, or was that a later addition?
So the murals were actually a later addition. So the initial tower, that there was not a plan to hold the 27 fresco murals that we have today. And that's in kind of in part some of the challenges, which I'll let Anne and David speak to, that the tower was not designed to actually house these world-class works of art. So that's something we'll be continued to be challenged with into the future. But really, they came later as a public works project, and I think speak to the importance of government's investment in arts and culture, of telling the story of the human condition and telling the story of history. And I think what's amazing about these murals is that the stories they tell are as relevant today as they were in 1934 when there was, you know, the development of this project. They were funded by federal dollars through the WP era, through the Works Project at the time. And I think the artists, you can certainly see in their work a narrative both of California history, covering everything from the wine industry or the kind of agriculture at the time to the industrial efforts of the time, as well as the labor struggles that were happening just down below from the tower. So, again, these are all issues that I think are very resonant still today and are quite timeless in the vision of those artists.
So I wanted to bring David Wessel in. He is the principal of Architectural Resources Group and CEO of ARG Conservation Services. And you were key in the restoration of not only the building but the murals themselves. Is
that
correct?
That's right.
So take us through your thinking or how you look at Coy Tower in terms of its architecture and where it sits within the city. You know, is this a do architects love this this structure? What kinds of responses or reactions do you have? What kinds of responses or reactions did others have at the time, a little bit more, digging a little bit more into what Tom had to say?
Well, Coy Tower is one of our most precious Art Deco monuments in San Francisco. And it was a pioneering use of reinforced concrete and was a very interesting building at the time when it was constructed. And as Tom mentioned, it was a design competition that Arthur Brown Jr. won. The tower was set in Pioneer Park, which had been completed in 1923. And the Rec and Park Department, after that design, as Tom said, decided to put this monument on the top of Telegraph Hill, and that's why it was somewhat controversial. But from a restoration standpoint, we have a building on one of the highest points in San Francisco that reaches up another almost 200 feet, and it catches all of the weather. It catches all of the difficult conditions that you have in a marine environment in San Francisco. And here we are trying to preserve this precious artwork. Not only that, it has flat roofs right over the artwork. We had...
And why is that significant?
Well, flat roofs are very difficult to waterproof. And in addition to that, when we started the investigation, we were trying to figure out where the water was coming from. There were leaks, and much of it was because of the original design of the building and the severe exposure that it is subjected to.
So what you're describing there is that, you know, what a building was originally intended to do matters to what it ultimately becomes used for.
Exactly. And not only that, we have artwork in a building that wasn't designed for the circulation and the type of visitation that we have now. And that was one of the most difficult problems that Reckon Park had been struggling with in the Arts Commission and what we still face now.
So you mentioned the leaks. What other structural issues did you have to grapple with?
Well, we had a building in which the reinforced concrete has been subjected to a marine environment all these years. And so the steel in the building was started to corrode that's embedded into the reinforced concrete, and so that had to be repaired. We also had, in addition, inside the building, what's kind of interesting is that there are steel tanks that are used to supply the water to the building for all of the plumbing. And so a pump raises the water up to these tanks, and we were concerned that maybe these tanks, which are original to the building, were maybe one of the sources of leaks. And so we hired a specialized team of investigators who dive into small spaces filled with water, and they inspected the tanks.
Wow.
And yeah, it was an interesting process, and we found that the tanks were in good condition, believe it or not. Installed originally, still there, still functioning, and we're happy to find that we didn't have to take those out. It would have been a tremendous effort to cut those large steel tanks out and take them down the stairway.
And then I want to bring in Ann Rosenthal, who helped restore the murals. Ann, tell us about the condition you found the murals in and what your first impressions were.
Well, actually, I think that the mural paintings this time around, I say this time because we worked on them 26 years ago. At that time, they were really in deplorable condition. And we're happier this time to see that much of the damage had been mitigated, in part because of a new guardrail system that is put in place that keeps the public from touching the murals, and it keeps the maintenance people from getting too close to them, and that has helped a great deal. One of the old favorite locations of water damage was back again, however, and they look just very familiar, in better condition than we left them the last time, but still had a number of damages that were common to the last treatment that really have to do with the use of the building, the structure of the building, and just the fact that there are so many people crowding into the building that they suffer the damages that are mostly accidental. What we saw the last time was quite a bit of graffiti that had been covered over, and I could speak a long time about the graffiti because it led to other problems. But this time, the damage was familiar. We had worked on it previously, and we were actually able to do a little more than we were able to do the last time because we didn't have to work in so many areas.
Mm. Tom, I wanted to ask you real quick, how many visitors per year?
Oh, my goodness. I might ask Cassandra to chime in with
Cassandra.
That.
Hi there. Historically, we've had roughly 200,000 visitors per year to the building.
And if I remember correctly on my visits there, it's a pretty tight space. So it's really hard to keep people from knocking into works of art, even with guardrails. Is that right?
I just wanted to say, yes, it is. It is true. Even with the guardrails, it's hard to move around and circulate totally freely in there. But there's a point I wanted to make, sort of following up David's comment about the fact that the building wasn't initially thought to be housing artwork. And one thing about the paintings that are in the space is that they are wall paintings. They are not, they can't be freely moved the way, you know, on and off a hook from the wall. And in being wall paintings, they are part of the structure of the building, so they can't get out of the way of the rain. And that's one of the big issues with them. And it's what is particular to wall paintings, that they have all of the problems of deterioration that occur to the building itself, whereas in another type of art museum, the art is actually mobile. It can be moved. It can be put on and off exhibition. And in this case, there is no way out.
Right. And it sounds like, David, you would have to, in trying to solve some of the architectural restoration challenges, that, you know, some of the solution could put the actual pieces in jeopardy, right? Because the problems may be right behind them, but you can't really get at them the normal way.
That's exactly right. And originally, the architect intended the second floor, which is can't be visited normally, that to be open to the public. But the stairway is very narrow, and it has these wonderful murals along the way on the way up. And then we have a flat roof that was originally clay tile and meant to be walked on. And that's been one of the biggest problems, is this trying to make sure the water is diverted into the drains and not into the building. It is a building that probably has all sorts of little connections and joints through it, through which the water can get down into the mural.
So did you ever find the source of the leaks?
We found every known source of leak.
Wow.
And we took care of it.
Excellent. And so were you expecting to, or was that a surprise that you're able to find all the leaks?
Well, we used a number of diagnostic tools. I had described one of them using the dive team, but we had infrared photography. We had moisture meters, and we had all sorts of actual close-range investigation of all of the historic fabric of the building. And so I think we did a pretty good job in isolating what needed to be treated and took care of it.
Hmm. And I wanted to we brought you in there for just a second, Cassandra Costello of San Francisco's Rec and Park Department. But I wanted to bring you in more fully at this part of the conversation just to hear from your standpoint, what are some of the challenges from the Rec and Park Department of managing a space like Pioneer Park and the building that sits very centrally within it?
Sure. Well, first, I just want to mention that it's much easier to manage a beautiful asset like this when we have these great partners, right? I mean, we get to work with Tom DeCagney on the co-management of this building. We are the proud owners of the building, and of course, the Arts Commission manages the murals. We do get a tremendous amount of visitorship to the site, and that comes with wear and tear of the park, and of course, we need to manage the visitors coming into the site. So we've worked really, really carefully with the Arts Commission, and every single move that we make, we have the utmost protection of the murals in mind. So with that, you know, we did just enter into a new lease agreement with a new concessionaire that's providing more access than ever to the murals that that Tom and David were just speaking about. You know, the second floor that's been limited public access due to the sensitive nature of the murals, we're able to now provide daily docent tours to the second floor murals and the first floor murals. So we're really, really excited about that. And we're also really excited that we were able to partner and get support from the mayor and the Board of Supervisors to actually allocate the necessary funding to do this restoration project. And through that funding, we're also able to do the mural restoration as well. And one other thing I wanted to point out in terms of ongoing management of this site, the revenue generated from the concessions at Coit Tower do support all of our park assets. However, we have a very unique agreement and arrangement that we're really proud of, and that is that 1% of the gross revenues generated from Coit Tower will be gifted to the Arts Commission for the ongoing maintenance of the murals. So hopefully, you know, we won't have this this problem later on where we have to allocate a tremendous amount of resources to restore the murals. We can kind of catch things as they go on and give them the real attention and love that they need on a day-to-day basis.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the restoration of San Francisco's Coit Tower with Tom DeCaney, Director of Cultural Affairs at the San Francisco Arts Commission, David Wessel, Principal at Architectural Resources Group, Ann Rosenthal, Principal with Ann Rosenthal Fine Arts Conservation, and just there on the phone was Cassandra Costello, Property Manager with the San Francisco Recreation and Park Department. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment at the KALW website. So staying with you for a moment, Cassandra, it sounds like the result of all the work is pretty exciting, and everyone feels like it went well. But getting the funding together in the first place, specifically the ballot measure that was passed in 2012, was not so easy. Could you review for us kind of what the process was that got the funding together?
You know, we actually been working for many years with ARG prior to the 2012 ballot measure, realizing that Coit Tower did need some love and attention. And so we were able to start those early meetings with David Chu, the president of the Board of Supervisors, and the mayor in order to secure the funding necessary to do that work. And we were really lucky to be able to continue to work with ARG on implementing the restoration project and making sure that everything was done, you know, up to the utmost historic code and whatnot. So we're really proud of the final product.
And how did Recon Park reconcile with the neighborhood and groups that were also interested and very vested in the in this area and to kind of come together around differences there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We had a tremendous amount of community engagement going back, actually, prior to the request for proposals issued in 2011 for the management of the concessions at Coit Tower. We had a number of meetings with the community to ask them what they really wanted to see at Coit Tower. I think everybody agreed that we needed to make some changes up there, and so we were able to take the input that we received as part of these community engagement processes and specifically put those asks in a concession for a concessionaire, and I think the concessionaire that was eventually selected through a robust community process and public process at the Recreation Park Commission and the Board of Supervisors is able to deliver on those requests, such as, you know, the museum shop now sells items that relate specifically to Coit Tower. They have a tremendous book selection that has, you know, the Zackheim, Masha Zackheim's story about Coit Tower, as well as a number of other beautiful stories, not just about Coit Tower, but San Francisco. They've partnered with Shine and Shine Map Company and Gorin Brothers, which are local businesses, to really provide a museum shop that locals and tourists alike will find some unique items. So those were some of the items, and also to just increase and enhance the visitor experience. So when you go to Coit Tower, one of the items that we heard from the community is that there wasn't enough history given when you go up to Coit Tower. So now we have trained staff who can speak very knowledgeably about San Francisco and the murals. All the staff at Coit Tower can now tell you in great detail about the history of Lily Coit, which Tom touched on, and the history of these amazing, unique murals. So it's definitely a different experience up there, and I would like to thank the community for urging us to and working with us to make that the case.
And this sounds like a quite a distance away from the original concerns from the public that perhaps the space was going to be shuttered and repurposed for private events only. How did you navigate that conversation? And is use of the tower for private events at all still on the table?
There are no special events allowed as part of this concession agreement. We're offering the robust mural tours, service to the top of the observation deck, which does offer, I think, if not the best, one of the best views, 360-degree views of San Francisco. Those are the opportunities that are available at Coit Tower, but there's no special events at this time.
All right. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. I want to get our first caller on the line. We have Zach from San Francisco. Zach, welcome to the program.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. I've been up to the observation deck. I was up there years ago. And I know that when you look at the building from afar and you're looking up toward the top, you can see a balustrade with a balcony. And I was wondering, is that ever open for tour, that area?
Do you mean the second floor?
I don't know if that's considered the second floor. It's up near the top. It's a balcony with a balustrade.
Right. That's called the Belvedere level.
The Belvedere level.
Right. And when you first get off of the elevator, you're actually at that location. And then you climb the stairs up to the very top observation point. And that area is open for individuals who are in wheelchairs or need to get out and helped out so that they can also enjoy the view there. But it's not normally open for the public.
I see. Okay. Because I know that from my experience of going up to the observation deck, the windows are rather small and narrow. And I just thought, from that balcony, it would be an unobstructed view and it would be amazing.
Well, it's interesting. The architect, if we look at the original drawings, the intent was to actually have a restaurant on that level. And so if you keep that in mind when you're up there and think how that might have played into the design, it's an interesting fact of the building that doesn't come out too often.
Thank you so much. Zach, for your call. You said earlier, David, that that the second floor is not open to the public. Is that right?
Well, yes. You can see the murals on the second floor, but going out on the roof, now that we've done all the work, we've made it waterproof, we don't want visitors on the second floor roof.
Okay. That was my question, is wondering why not. Yeah.
Joseph, just Tom. To add, there are some murals on the second floor just above when you're in the lobby with the main murals. They're still actually going through the conservation effort, and we anticipate them to be done in about a month's time. But to Cassandra's point, the steps we've taken to enhance access and the signage and the historical context of the murals has been quite great in this conservation effort. So in addition to what has been a longstanding practice of our partners at City Guides, where you could actually, through a City Guides tour, access those murals on the second story, and I'll ask Anne to maybe tell us a little bit more about them. But we also now, to Cassandra's point, have that docent access. So you can, once they're completed with the conservation effort as a member of the public, either take a docent tour or go through the City Guides tour, which are some incredible tours, and they've been a wonderful longtime partner in making sure the public has a full kind of historical context of the work up there. I'll also say that one of the other outcomes of this conservation effort has been in partnership with Harvey Smith, who's a local WPA scholar affiliated with the Living New Deal Project, who's actually helped develop signage for all of the murals in the main space. So before, if you were a member of the public, you kind of had to maybe get out your iPhone and check it out and try to research them on your own accord. Or if you were fortunate enough to be on a City Guides tour, you had maybe a docent leading you. But in addition to now having the vendor have regular docents on site, there's also signage at each of the murals. So if you're a member of the public who perhaps doesn't know as much about the site, you're able to read about them. And I think that enhances the visitor experience immensely.
Speaking of which, we have Pat from San Francisco on the line, and Pat wants to know a little bit more about the tours. Welcome to the program, Pat.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have interns in my office, and one of the field trips I'd like them to take is to the Coit Tower, because even though they're local, they've never been. And I've been talking it up that it's renovated and it's ready to go. And I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more information about how we would schedule a docent tour and what the cost might be.
Great questions, Pat. This is Cassandra Costello with Reckon Park.
coittowertours.com is the vendor's website. You can also email me at cassandra.costello@sfgov.org, and I can put you in touch with the president of the organization to arrange a tour. They do tours all the time for school groups, for senior groups, or just general members of the public, folks, you know, coming in groups of 2, 3, and 4. There are conditions set forth that allow only a small number of people on a tour because the second floor murals are more delicate than the ground floor murals in terms of the protections in place. They're difficult to protect. And so we do have a very close monitoring system in conjunction with the Arts Commission. But I highly encourage you and your students to secure a tour and to go take a tour up there.
Great. Thanks, Cassandra.
Thank you.
Cassandra, wanted you to take this next one. It's actually an email from...
Okay.
Richard, he says, I think I heard right that 1% of revenues are dedicated to a restoration reserve and that the Parks Department is proud of that. It sounds awfully small given the recent cost of renovation. How much will it generate annually? The murals are one of the main attractions of Coit Tower, and if they are not maintained, the tower may no longer be as attractive.
Yeah, great question. We're actually anticipating gross revenues to be on par with about $1.3 million in revenue. And so that's the $13,000 that this would produce is actually a higher number than the Arts Commission. And I would defer to Tom exactly how much the annual maintenance would be. In past conversations, it sounds like that would more than cover the annual kind of maintenance and restorative work that would be needed to keep the murals on par.
Tom?
Yes, thank you, Cassandra. And I think this point of the partnership between the Arts Commission and the Recreation and Parks Department is an important one. It's important to keep in mind the deferred maintenance on our cultural assets across the city. So prior to my arrival at the Arts Commission in 2012, the Arts Commission received a total of $15,000 annually for care of the entire civic art collection across the city of San Francisco.
And how many pieces is that, roughly speaking?
There are over 4,000 objects. So to have this dedicated ongoing stream for the maintenance of one of our major cultural assets is a landmark moment, and it's a really, I think, important testament to Rec Park's commitment to ensuring the ongoing maintenance. And the $13,000 is estimated to cover 2 annual cleanings. So the report that ARG has done has outlined some guidelines for the annual maintenance, and with a dedicated stream of funding, we'll be able to do ongoing cleaning and observation of the murals to ensure regular maintenance. I think it's also important to note that we, between the Arts Commission and Recreation and Park, have a very extensive joint authority across the city for cultural assets throughout the city that don't have revenues. And it's really critical that we remember the murals at the Beach Chalet, other WP era assets that are as critical to historical context as these murals at Coit Tower. So our partnership goes beyond a single site, but is really looking at citywide. How do we endeavor to give the attention and care to our civic art collection?
This is City Visions on local public radio, KLW San Francisco, and on the web at KLW.org. And tonight we're discussing the restoration of Coit Tower with Tom DeCaney, that was him right there, Director of Cultural Affairs with the San Francisco Arts Commission, David Wessel with Architectural Resources Group, Ann Rosenthal with Ann Rosenthal Fine Arts Conservation, and by phone, Cassandra Costello with the San Francisco Recreation and Parks Department. So again, we invite you to call in with questions and comments, 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klwr.org. That hasn't been our email for such a long time, and yet it's stuck in my head. And then we can also post a comment at the KLW website. And so I want to go now to Patricia from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. Could you say a few words about what kind of earthquake upgrading might have been undertaken with the recent renovation of Coit Tower?
There was not any earthquake upgrades undertaken, and it was not studied. The building falls outside any of the city's requirements because it's a reinforced concrete building. So it's not an unreinforced masonry building. And for that reason, waterproofing and the conservation of the murals and code upgrades was the scope of work.
Thank you.
All right. And just one more time, since I was fumbled on that, cityvisions@klw.org is our email. You can post a comment at the KLW website. And the number to call is 415-841-4134. So, Anne, I want to turn now to the murals in a little bit more detail. So could you give us a sort of visual radio tour of the murals, the ones that you're most that you were most engaged with during this process, and the ones that, you're really very touched by?
Well, that covers quite a bit right there.
We have half an hour.
All right. The I should start probably by saying that I'm not the only one who has been working on this project. I have two very skilled and talented colleagues, Jim Bernstein of San Francisco and Gregory Thomas of Hawaii. We also had an assistant working with us, Jeremy Allen, who works with Jim. And their contributions to this project are all over the walls there. The reason it looks so beautiful is because of our combined effort. So I want everyone to know that this was not just myself alone. I would still be there. But the murals in the Koi Tower are mostly fresco paintings, but there are several works on canvas, oil paintings on canvas that are marouflaged, that is directly adhered to the walls in the elevator lobby. And there is one egg tempera mural that is on the second floor.
What is that? That?
Egg tempera?
Mm-hmm.
It is paint that has as a binder the oak of, or the yolk of eggs. So pigments ground in the yolk of eggs and diluted sometimes, and there can be other additions to the paint, but it is basically an egg binder. It's a very old technique, very old type of painting.
So when I think of frescoes, I think of, you know, churches in Italy.
I'm sure
there's frescoes everywhere, a lot of other places, but that's the first thing that comes to mind. Given the weather and climate issues that David brought up in the beginning of the program, how do frescoes hold up? Were frescoes the right way to paint in that space, let alone the architectural concerns that came up
perhaps
earlier?
Perhaps it is the best material. If those leaks actually have been finally stopped, I'm sure they have been because they've combed every inch of the building. Frescoes are typically a very, very strong and durable type of medium. It's the application of pigments that are dry pigments that are then ground in water, applied dilute, sometimes a little stronger, with brush to fresh plaster. It's usually a three-step coating of plaster, two scratch coats, and a finish coat. And the artist has to work very quickly in small sections. He works directly with a plasterer who sets up the plaster for the day, and the artist has to work before that plaster is dry. There's no actual binder to the paint. Paints are usually a binder and a pigment. The way a fresco has its sticking ability, so to speak, is that it does absorb into the wall itself. But the main way that it is strengthened is by it's drying in the air.
Let's talk a little bit more about the paintings themselves. So tell us about some of the ones that struck you in terms of their the subject matter. And I open this up to actually any of the guests to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, we do have our favorites, and yet we shouldn't say, I suppose, which ones they are.
No
one's listening. But I have to say that we do have one that stands out, and perhaps it was partly because we met the artist 26 years ago. He was still alive, John Langley Howard, who painted the beautiful painting that is in the north hallway. It's it just has everything. It has a beautiful painting style. It was, I'm told, the one and only painting in fresco that he ever did, which is astounding because fresco is a very difficult medium to master. And he has workers on the left standing in line, very brave and bold. He has new technology. He has people in front of a newly constructed dam. He has the down and outs of society forward in the foreground of the painting. He has the rich elites on the side with their fancy car and their fancy dogs and so on. He has a lot of contrast, and yet at the same time, it's in a wonderful California landscape. It's just a beautiful painting in every respect. So that's one that sticks out, and I have to say it's my personal favorite.
Maybe let's ask Tom, what's one of your favorites?
Well, it's your children. You can't pick one. But I think what I'm fascinated by is the story of the artists and the relationships that they developed at that time working together. It was a time of labor unrest. It was a time of new technologies, as Anne mentioned. And these themes are so resonant today. I mean, you could really envision, a number of artists getting together and working in the context today, and the themes would very much be the same. Income inequality, income disparity, kind of new technologies and the impact those technologies have on society. The negotiation between labor and these technologies about how do we, kind of settle this income disparity that continues to be an issue across our country. And so I think these artists were really capturing a moment in time, but something that is very resonant today. And it's also worthy to note that it was one of the few first public art projects where women were very prominent. So there were two lead female artists in the team of the 27 frescoes, a number of assistants that were women. And so it was, kind of had a gender diversity to it that I think in the WPA projects, we don't see as visibly. And it was groundbreaking in that regard. And there's,
do you know how the artists were actually selected?
I don't know that offhand. I don't know if David or Anne know.
Because the reason I ask that is I wonder if the people who funded the project kind of knew what was going to come of it in terms of the messages that ended up being portrayed on the walls. Because I'm not sure if any of you can answer this, but how was that art received in terms of not only its aesthetic, but in terms of its message, very politicized message?
Well, it was upstaged a little bit by a controversial painting that one of the artists put on the walls with a communist banner, and this caused a great stir in the city, and the tower was closed for a short time. So that seemed to overshadow some of the initial delivery of the messages in the tower. But by and large, I think they were received very, very well. The themes of the paintings are the industry of California and the life in California. So there is one section devoted to production of, industries, and another the production of food, and then the life that comes from that, the music shop, the city street, city life, panel by Victor Arnatov, very outstanding mural, and all of the aspects of California life. So not only are they the activities of the day, but they're also the landscape of our state.
But David, there was a pretty clear message that some of these muralists were trying to send.
Absolutely. But what I find interesting is that on the ground floor, we have these murals that Tom and Anne described. And when we go upstairs, we find that other side of life. And that is an upper class drawing room or maybe a private club depicted in the paintings up there. and there's a piano, and people have drinks in their hand, and they're having a nice evening. And so it's very different once you go upstairs to see some of the contrast up there.
Well, the theme was recreation in that, area, and the bridge between them is the beautiful stairway by Lucien Lambeau, who painted both sides of Powell Street. It's just an outstanding painting.
I would add, one of the great opportunities I've had in my role is to interview a number of the descendants of the murals, muralists for StoryCorps, and to hear their stories. And I think what's really interesting is many of them identified their parents as not political or apolitical, that they were really seeing themselves as reflecting what they were observing at the time. And so I think it's complex to understand whether or not the artists were intending a political message. Some murals, absolutely. You know, Karl Marx's literature is on the wall, and I'm pretty certain there would be political intent to
it. Is that the Zakheim piece, the library?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so there was clearly some muralists who were, I think, contextualizing politics in their work, but in hearing from the descendants that not necessarily were they coming forward with a political agenda, but were looking at their work as reflective of society and kind of telling the story of what they were experiencing. So,
it's only through the lens of history that we've overlaid this idea of a political intent.
Yes, I think in many ways many artists work observationally and reflect back kind of what they're seeing in society. And sometimes artists come with a very clear political message or kind of a perspective. And again, we all have perspectives. And I think in the response, we saw that as well in a very broad response where it was closed for a while because of some response to signifiers that were included in the imagery. But there were other people that loved that fact that imagery was included, and that also that this demonstrated the labor struggles of the time. And so I think it goes to show that there's usually a pretty broad reaction in public art, and that people could take very different opinions on the matter.
And I wonder, because it was in a public space, that it was allowed to stay. Thinking back to the Diego Rivera mural at Rockefeller Center that depicted Lenin, that was then chiseled out. So what's your sense there? Do you think because it was in a public space that there was more of a accommodation for this kind of imagery?
Yeah, well, I like to think it's because we're in San Francisco.
And
I think
fair enough.
In San Francisco, we have I think, a space in San Francisco for rigorous democratic debate that in many cities you don't see as robust as we do in San Francisco. And I think that's one of our great strengths as a city. And I think we're seeing that perhaps just as much now as we did in the 1930s.
In the last 10 minutes or so of the program, I just wanted to put our phone number out again. It's 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 to join our conversation here at City Visions on KLW and KLW.org, where we're discussing the renovation of Coit Tower and its murals. We have Tom DeCaney from the San Francisco Arts Commission, David Wessel of Architectural Resources Group, Anne Rosenthal of Anne Rosenthal Fine Arts Conservation, and Cassandra Costello with the San Francisco Recreation and Park Department. Have you seen the newly restored tower and murals? Do you have a favorite painting or a memory of the tower? 415-841-4134, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So staying with the murals, so we talked about some of the technical challenges of restoring, trying to find the leaks and repair them. What were some of the other issues what did you have to do to make this work?
Well, some of the other issues are simply ones of maintenance. There is the accidental damage that has happened to them. There are a number of scrapes and gouges and abrasions to the surface. There's also a great deal of accumulated soil from airborne soot and fly specks, insect nests, and so on, that have attached to the surface of the paintings. There are old restorations too. I have to add there's a history of restoration that has happened at the tower. It was restored twice before 89, I would say, and then again in 92. So there are three major campaigns that have gone on to restore the murals. Actually, what I'd like to say is that restoration is really different from conservation, which is what I do. We're trained professionals in the field of art conservation, and it's very different from being an artist. The first two campaigns took place under artists' hands, so they were muralists to begin with. And the field has really evolved since that time, and we have become an occupation, a profession unto ourselves, sort of. We have improved the field a great deal. It's we have a professional organization, the American Institute of Conservation for Historic and Artistic Works. There's a great deal of collegial exchange and information that we present in annual meetings and blogs and so forth. But most of us have training in the field of art conservation, even though there are many different specialties: textiles, books and paper, digital media. There's a huge, broad gamut of specialties.
So I want to get to another caller here. Nancy from Berkeley, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to know if Diego Rivera's beautiful murals are still in Coit Tower. I'm trying to get a ride from Berkeley over to the city just because of this program tonight. And he was definitely there when I was growing up in San Francisco. So that's all my comment and question.
Thank you, Nancy. So is there a Diego Rivera?
There's not a Diego Rivera at Coit Tower, but there is one at the San Francisco Art Institute on Chestnut Street, which is just across the way from Coit Tower. Diego Rivera was in San Francisco in 1931, and I'm sure he influenced those artists at Coit quite profoundly. He had many followers, and it was Walter Heil, who was the director of the De Young Museum, who chose at that time the medium of fresco to go into Coit Tower. Mm-hmm. I should also say that four of the large standing portraits by Clifford White were executed by one of Diego Rivera's assistants, who was also a very skilled plasterer.
Who was that?
Clifford White.
Oh, Clifford White. Sorry, you mentioned that. Sorry. So the crosstalk there is definitely evident. In the last few moments of the program, I wanted to think about how Coit Tower remains an icon in the city, but would we ever see something like Coit Tower again? And what I mean to say by this is that oftentimes buildings that are meant to be monumental really start with the function that they serve, let's say a museum or a performing arts center, and then the shape takes place around it, and the monument and the building is created, but it's really in service perhaps to the function. And maybe I'm simplifying it a little too much, but I'm curious if, and I'm looking at you, David, if you see something like a Coit Tower happening today, and what how does our look back at Coit Tower now and this restoration make us see a historical moment that may have passed?
Well, that's a tough question because we don't have the perspective of time. But if you're asking if we are designing and building monuments that will stand the test of time and 100 years from now be recognized for their value and for their reflection of our society and our culture, I think absolutely yes. And I think that we have many examples in San Francisco and in the Bay Area of monuments to be.
And so what's your sense, though, about this, and perhaps my thesis is wrong, but this notion that, you know, I mean, I think of it as a monument, and that was its original purpose, and then, of course, then other functions got added onto it. But, you know, if I think of other grand spaces, it's really the institutional function, and then the building comes
around it. Do you see what I'm getting at there?
I do. But remember, it was built as an observation building. It was built for the masses to come and enjoy the city. And so it's that perspective of time and what was added to it, the artwork, and everything that happened since that has given it its significance that we recognize today.
And Anne, what's your take on the historical significance that we already can appreciate, but we may come to appreciate even more about the murals in that space?
It's a singular building. It's absolutely unique. If you're a San Franciscan and haven't seen it, you must go. If you're a visitor, you must go. It's really a very special place. I think as time goes on, we see that the scale is different. The times are still relevant. And the painting technique, absolutely outstanding. These were the best artists of the Bay Area. And I encourage everyone to take a look.
And how much is the admission cost?
The admission is free.
Go ahead, Cassandra.
Oh, yes, Anne is correct. The admission is free to view the murals on the base floor. However, to take a ride to the top of the observation deck to take in the higher views, it is $5 at a discounted senior rate and $7 for resident rate, and then $7 for a non-resident visitor rate.
I was just making the point there that for what you describe and its significance, the fact that you can just walk right in and look at it is pretty remarkable without having to open your wallet. And Tom, how is the Arts Commission looking at this project and its seeming success as a driver for trying to restore other murals or other works of art in public spaces that belong to the San Francisco Arts Commission? Well, I'm thrilled to say that Mayor Lee and the Board of Supervisors in the budget review this year are dedicating over $300,000 to the Civic Art Collection and its care. This includes beginning work on some wonderful fountains by Ruth Asawa in Japantown. It includes additional resources into the community for the conservation of a mural on 24th Street, the Carnival mural, as part of the Calle 24 Latino Cultural District that has recently been passed. So I think we're seeing an unprecedented investment in our cultural assets. Also, for those interested in murals, the Beach Chalet murals have also been dedicated some resources to give some conservation care to them as well. So I think we're seeing an unprecedented – we have a much better economy. So as a city, we're able to do better in terms of all of our assets and our care of deferred maintenance. But I think we're really seeing an unprecedented commitment to the Civic Art Collection and its care. And as the Arts Commission, we're looking to plan long-term both through – good economic times and difficult economic times to plan accordingly. And for new public art, we're really thinking about the long-term care much more closely. Mm-hmm. So what are the materials we're using? What are the kind of environmental factors that make it more difficult to care for in the long run? But to make sure that we're engaging artists to make new art and care for it for the long term. So we're going to have to stop there, unfortunately. But I really appreciate this conversation about a San Francisco icon. That's the Coit Tower that we were talking about tonight. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Tom DeCaney, Director of Cultural Affairs at the San Francisco Arts Commission, David Wessel, Principal of Architectural Resources Group, Anne Rosenthal, Principal of Anne Rosenthal Fine Arts Conservation, and Cassandra Costello, Property Manager with San Francisco Recreation and Park Department. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. I'll be away for a few weeks. Join my co-host, David Onick, next Monday as we discuss the new work by Bay Area researchers on the human microbiome. What is that, you ask? Well, tune in to listen. This is Joseph Bache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.